My mother used to make herring bran for herself, as no one else had the taste for it. But it was made in her mother's home, and the first fresh herrings were usually cooked in that way. Clean and scale the herrings, small quantity beforehand. 2 herrings, 1 leek, chopped parsley, 2 teaspoonfuls of oatmeal, and 1 cup of water. Simmer for 30 minutes. Brat supped and the herring eaten afterwards with either bread or potatoes. Invariably, mother quoted the following doggerel. The head of a herring and the tail of a leek will keep an old Irish woman the whole of a week. Mashed potatoes were eaten with buttermilk poured over them. A basin of buttermilk was served to each person at the table. Oat cake was also broken up into buttered milk and eaten just like porridge. Sometimes caraway seeds were put in the soda cake. My grandmother Convery grew them on her own. Also currants were added. The rolling pin was not used to make the barley bread or oat cake. By a movement of the palm of the hand on a piece of the dough, it was shaped to the required size and baked on the griddle. In each neighborhood, there was a keen competition as to who could clap the thinnest cake and barley bread. A barley meal bunnag was made from equal parts of barley meal and flour. A piece of lard, the size of a walnut or a little more, to 1 pound of meal and flour. Pinch of salt, 1/2 teaspoonful cream of tartar, mixed in the dry ingredients, level teaspoonful of bicarbonate of soda, also dissolved in just enough buttermilk to mix to an ordinary dough. Shaped into one or two fairly flat loaves and baked on the oven shelf about 30 minutes. Before the ovens came in, pot ovens would be used. Salted foods were greatly used as shops were not near the scattered country homes. Pigs were killed and salted, also sheep. My brother-in-law, Captain Gill, a nephew of Neddy Humray of Craignish, told me that his father killed and salted their own sheep, and how specially good the little sheep, upland sheep, were for salting in comparison with the bigger breeds. Then there were barrels of salt herrings in every home. Mackerel was also salted and boiled, and as the herrings were, with the potatoes. Another way with mackerel and splitting and salting overnight, then peppering them well and hanging them in the air to dry with a small stick stuck across the wings to keep them flat. Herrings were soaked in water to take out some of the salt for about 3 nights, and then they were hung out to dry with a rod, especially kept passed through the eyes. Both mackerel and herrings were cooked on a roaster hung in front of the fire bars of the fire grate. The mackerel was termed kippered. The roe of the cod was also salted for 24 hours and hung out to dry. Then it was split in 2 ends, also roasted in front of the fire. This was so passed cheese. It was commonly called the pay or the britches. Cod was salted and dried, and congers were done the same way. Bullock's liver was salted, like the raw and dried, and it is very unusual and very tasty flavour. When the boats returned from Kinsale fishing, a number of the men brought home with them small kegs of salted liver. Fresh meat was eaten mainly on Sundays. Also, in some shops could be bought the salted buffalo, which came in huge casks. There was a shop in Portrait Mary which sold it. In fact, the shopkeeper sold his bit of everything. Consequently, he was called Willie Gone Everything. He had a brother who was lazy and called himself Tampon Nothing. Tampon was his nickname. At the present time, many ladies smoke cigarettes, but in days gone by, it was a clay pipe. I well remember a beggar woman living at Calvi, whom we called the old feather woman because she walked around with huge bags of feathers on her back. Those she sold to help her live, and a bit of begging too. She often sat in Portrait Mary railway station waiting room smoking her clay pipe and would ask any man for tobacco. Mainly it was done on the sly by the women. My mother explained to me the reason so many women smoked. It seems that the old couple would be working in the field, thinning and weeding and that. The children would have to be helping as well. If it was a windy day, the old man couldn't light his pipe in the field, and, not to lose time, would send one of the children, boy or girl, to the shelter of the hedge to light up and keep drawing on it until the old man got his pipe back. My mother had to do it, but nearly always feeling sick, she never became a smoker. I remember my mother saying how boys wore petticoats and frocks until they were quite big. It was common for a boy to be breeched, as they called it, when they were about 7 years old. Flannel stays, homemade, roughly quilted and bound with tapes, a tape bound over to the shoulders and tied in front with tapes. Grey calico shirts, drawers and a flannel petticoat with herringbone stitching and feather stitch work sometimes in black and sometimes in white along the hems of a frock and a pinafore completed the outfit for the boys. Babies wore bonnets a long time, indoors and out, and their short sleeves were tied up on each shoulder with a bow of ribbon. The following notes were given to me by Mr. John Collister of Kewaig. His age is 82 years, and he is still very straight in figure and tall. Born at Balladool, Arbury, he had many interesting stories. His mother was a fully qualified nurse and often attended six people in place of a doctor. Being a widow, her son John was reared by his grandfather, Cannell, who had a stonecutter's yard at Balladool near Fisher's Hill. Fisher's Hill was so called from a man named Fisher who farmed Balladool Farm previous to George Moore. Stonecutter Cannell quarried the Poolvash marble and made it into tombstones. He had three men, sometimes four, working for him. The marble was also made into mantelpieces, and for a week at a time the men would be staying in Douglas, putting these mantelpieces in the newly built houses, mostly boarding houses. He also spoke of another quarry which he called Petrified Stone. He told of his grandfather making a piece of petrified stone into the shape of an opal Bible being published, which he gave to a friend named Parry, a soldier stationed at Castletown prior to the departure of the soldiers from the Castletown barracks. There was a school at Balladoole kept by a man named Cannell, nicknamed William Paddy. The school was kept in a house which was the Sunday school also. Mr. Callister attended there, but I may say that my mother also attended William Paddy's school. From Mr. Callister I learned that there was a dozen boys and a dozen girls. They were all in the one room, the long desk being for the older boys, and the other doubled desks were used for the rest. The fees were tuppence for the young ones per week, threepence for the next, and fourpence for the bigger ones. The scholars had to provide their own slates, pencils, and papers. There were no maps on the wall. If the scholars of William Paddy's school did not have their money each Monday morning, they were sent home for it. An aunt of mine went to his school, and she could not learn her letters. William Paddy would shut her up in a pantry at the dinner time to learn them. Aunt would climb through the windows, go home for dinner, and come back the same way. A flat leather strap was used for punishment with a thick handle on it. The master sat on a chair in front of the class and sometimes would fall asleep with a wide open mouth and grunting. Once a scholar crept up and dropped a Manx knob into his mouth. The master woke up quite naturally and said, "Oh, thank you very much." At the bottom of Fisher's Hill were cottages known as the labourers' flats, or flat. That was the name of the field in which they were built. He mentioned a species of grass which he called shivering grass, and, as far as he knew, Balladoole was the only place on the island where it grew. And there was a plant he mentioned was called by the name of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve had separate roots, and when they were pulled or dropped into the water, one sank and the other floated, hence the name. One was a fairly deep red in colour, the other pink. He thought that the pink one would be called Eve. Both this plant and the shivering grass grow in Fisher's Meadows. The ropes used at a day school and the chapel and Sunday. The room was used as a day school and was chapel and Sunday school also. The pulpit was in the rooms, and as well as children, men and women went as well. The schoolmaster used a flat piece of leather with shaped handles to slap the boys' hands. The Sunday school teachers were Miss Blanche Stevenson and Miss Frieda Stevenson of Balladoole Mansion, along with the Mr. Bryson and Mr. Cannell, William Paddy. When the Balladoole school closed through the death of William Paddy, Mr. Callister attended Ballabeg School. and Mr. Cummins was the master. Mr. Callister told me of a fairy house at the milestone on the Castletown Road, on the opposite side to Bolladool Gate. It is still there. People passing at night have seen lights burning when it was unoccupied. At one time, a man named John Iser lived in it. Mr. Callister described a fight at the Grenier, Kentrol, between two soldiers from Castletown Barracks and a man named Harry Brew, who was a mighty strong man and could stand a knock on his head from a hammer without flinching. The two soldiers had pinched Harry Brew's girl. Some offensive mark was made, and Harry drew out the belt of one soldier and belted both of them, left them lying in the road, and walked away. Mr. Callister went to the fishing as a boy. On one occasion he went sailing to England, Holyhead, and came home with his wages, 10 golden sovereigns and a half sovereign, and was proud to bring them home to his grandparents. The next season he went on a sprang new boat called the Harvest Home and came home with 13 golden sovereigns, 16 shillings, 2 shillings for every Sunday, and a big bag of fish. He once fell overboard with a keg of fresh water in his arms and remarked that he couldn't close his eyes underwater and could distinctly see the bottom of the boat. Tobacco was not weighed, but measured with a stick. He can remember when there was no promenade at Port St. Mary, but from the Smelt Hill it was one long brew. Beside the labourer's flat was a field called the Gravel Field, where a man walked around all night and couldn't find his home until the morning. There was another Mr. Cannell, a stonecutter, who worked at his trade in Liverpool, but returned to Bolladool to work. He later became an overseer for Russian. Those who lived or were born at Bolladool always referred to it as the Borders. He was said that a field of corn was all stooped in one night by the fairies in a field belonging to Charlie Convery, and that Charlie Convery was my grandfather. Mr. Callister's grandson sold the produce in Castletown to Mr. Thompson the grocer. Eggs were sold to him at 40 for a shilling and 10 pence a pound for the beautiful fresh butter. What she brought home in return was tea and sugar for the week and fresh meat for Sundays. But they lived well at home, and the best of butter, milk, cream, eggs, cheese, fresh vegetables, and plenty of salt beef, fish, and bacon. There was no market for potatoes, and the cartloads were kicked into the field for the hens. In the very old part of Russian churchyard, now closed, is a headstone with the following inscription: "High traveller, stop as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I, As I am now, so will you be. So be prepared to follow me. A schoolboy attending the Russian school just past the churchyard, named Johnny Taylor, who in later life lived at Balaguini Gardens, wrote the following lines in chalk beneath the inscription: "To follow thee was my intent, but I did not know which way thou went. Hither to heaven or to hell, thou didst not come back to me to tell." Mr. Edward Gone of Kentraw went to the school about it, and asked for the lad who wrote it. No boy would own up until Mr. Gone insisted. He told the boy he was very clever and give him 5 shillings. When my father was station master at Port St. Mary, many of his friends gathered there for yarns. The late Mr. Clegg and Mr. Thomas Moore of Brookfield, then writing their books, Manx Reminiscences, they were often conferring with him over the Manx language. From time to time, the doctor and Mr. Moore differed, and they would consult father, and it would be decided 2-1. My father could read, write, and translate the many Manx language, and though he never went to school, I have it in his own handwriting how he learned his letters by asking someone to write, who could write, to get him a copy, and he studied that at nights. Other varying worthy friends were Mr. John Moore, builder and contractor and a joiner, Mr. James Moore, his son, Mr. Thomas Less, rope manufacturer, and Mr. Thomas Qualtro, harbour master, Mr. Henry Kelly, Balaguini Farm, the Reverend C.H. Leese, vicar, later Canon Leese, all spoke the Manx. Canon Leese and his father often read their Manx Bibles in preference to the English and talked together on the meanings. He also conversed fluently with those Frenchmen who came round from Brittany selling onions. Father spoke mainly the Manx to them. Then my aunt speaks about a lot of games which they used to play as school children. There'll be too many to put in this reminiscence that I'm doing now this afternoon. This next paragraph is headed Witchcraft. My mother told me this story. Her mother had a good cow, which gave fine milk and butter. Then the cow seemed to fail and gave less milk. Her first thought was, the cow's butched. Now there was an old one going around called Pay, who was able to give charms, etc., and she tried often to persuade grandmother to have a charm to get the cow better, but my grandmother held her for a long time, and at last she gave in and got the charm. Pye said not to open it, but to put it in the cowhouse. It looked just like a piece of dirty rag, and grandmother couldn't resist looking inside. To her horror and disgust, there was a louse in it. Needless to say, it went on the fire, and all the beliefs of Butcherang went too. A little bag with luck herbs in it was often stitched inside the stays. Blood stabbing is still carried out. At least it was done quite recently by Mrs. Dobson to a TT rider after a spill. I well remember living at Port Soderick Station House of one of the plate layers stopping blood. I did not witness it, but my brother Harry, who was the station master, saw it. The gangers had to work hard between the trains to lay new lengths of rail when the ganger, Mr. Cowan, late of Kewaig, got his hand hurt and was bleeding badly and getting faint. Another plate layer, Edward Kelly, once a Foxdale miner and father of Mr. Wilfred Kelly, retired schoolmaster of Russian now, said, "Howl on, boys," and walking away, turned his back on the man, bared his bent head, and said his piece to himself. And my brother says he saw the blood stopping, and the ganger after a while resumed his work. Next time you eat a herring, you must also eat the swim or float, that's that little silvering piece, and then you will never drown. I can't vouch for any proof, but my cousin always ate it with the rest of the herring. At Kroger Glen, there is a wishing well. It is called the Fairy Well Wood, and Mr. Joe Turbman, also Mrs. Turbman, now 84, has told me how many people came to the well and wish and would leave a silver coin for the fairies. Mr. Turbman was footman and then coachman for Kroger, but he also worked there, and then he found out that a man named Collett lifted all the money for himself in that well. A man once owned a very fine sow, but every litter of pigs was dying for him. So he thought it was time to see Nan Weird about it. So off he went and told Nan Weird all that happened. Says she, "There's a man coming into thy house very often, and he's got his eye on the sow." "No, no," says the man, "he's me best friend. He's all right. Thou'll get leave," says Nan, "but that's the trouble." So she told him what to do. "Take this packet of herbs, and the next time the man comes into thy house, just carry out these instructions. When he is gone for 5 minutes, put the pot on the fire and with the water and the herbs. And after another 5 minutes, pop an egg into the pot. And 5 minutes after that, pop another egg in. And after another 5 minutes, pop another egg in. Boil them all for 5 minutes and give the water to the sow to drink. Now, go thee ways and good luck to you," says Nan. Now each time the egg was put into the pot, there was a noise like a pelt of a gun, which made the man wonder. Well, next time the man visited the house where the sow was, he was limping. He explained to the friend that the last time he was there and had left the house about 5 minutes, he heard a pelt and then felt something striking him on the behind. And after a while the same thing happened, and it happened a third time. But the uncommon thing about it was that when the brew was given to the sow, there wasn't a trace of an egg or eggshell in the pot. The sow got well and had many a fine litter of pigs after that. That was told to me, my aunt remarks, from a Mrs. Comish of Brookfield Terrace, Foxdale, whose mother told her. referring to the vocabulary of the Anglo-Manx dialect of Mr. A. W. Moore, Mr. Morrison, and Mr. Goodwin, I note the word Gramercy's means refuse of food, rubbish, trash, also mixture. So no doubt it was mixture. My mother used to use that word when she was going to cook. She said she was going to make a Gramercy. She made a calf mixture containing the following ingredients: 1 ounce of burleek, 1 ounce of linseed, 1 ounce of Spanish juice, 1 ounce of sugar candy bought at the chemist, and 1 glass of white wine vinegar. 1 glass of rum was optional. Honey instead of sugar candy may be used. It is a wine, and take a wine glass full 3 or 4 times a day. It is said to move the most stubborn calf. Ointment was made by rendering the pure leaf lard of the pig and putting a handful of marshmallow leaves in to simmer with it and a teaspoonful of sugar. Strain through the muslin into small jars. It is a wonderful cleanser of gatherings. My mother had a remarkable knowledge of herbs, and mother would sometimes join Mrs. Killier when she was picking herbs. They would have a very interesting time, the pair of them. My mother had a great knowledge, too, of the different herbs, but she did not know which was which for all ailments. She was a good gardener and interested and understood there was a herb grown for every ailment. Mrs. Killier told my mother to get some wild garlic roots. They grow in abundance at Port Roderick. Chop them up and mix them with pure lard. Put a poultice on the sole of each foot and leave them on all night to cure her bronchitis. It was supposed to draw all the impurities out of the body.